Well, thank you all for being here. My name is Randy Hoggins, and I work for Microsoft. I've been at Microsoft for about 3 years. I also have with me here, you may want to turn that down just a bit. Yeah. Okay. Also, Jim Pinkerton is here. Jim is my co-author on this presentation. Over the last 6 months or so, Jim and I and about six other people have been working to document the File Access Services system as a system, as more than just a collection of protocols. We've been working to try to give an overview of how the system works as a whole. So the problem that we've been addressing is, as you probably know if you've looked at the individual protocol documents, they're individually quite complete, quite in-depth. We hope more and more accurate, largely or substantially because of the good feedback we've gotten from those who've used them. They're getting better all the time. But the they're pretty dry, and it takes quite a bit of integrative work reading across multiple protocol documents to try to get a sense of how the whole system works. And so there was a piece that was missing, which is this system overview. So that's what we decided to tackle that. And so what we're trying to do is doing in this document is to provide more information about how the protocols can be used in combination to implement the system. And by doing so, or doing that, providing information about sequences of interactions between protocols and how the protocols depend on external components. In other words, which parts of the system are internal to the system and which parts are external to the system. So our goals are to document how the member protocols, so-called member protocols, and that's a key word, by the way, the system overview template requests that we define member protocols and external protocols. So we define how member protocols work together to implement the file access services. So the member protocols are the ones that are listed here, SIFS and SMB and SMB2, and the file system control codes. Those together what we call generically the SMB access protocols, because they give the full description of the various forms of the SMB protocol. Then there's the DFS referral protocol, which provides the DFS distributed file system extensions. We also have the NFS protocols. Our use of the NFS protocols that's supported by Windows is documented in the system overview. And then there's these five administrative protocols, the RAP, the workstations, the remote access, remote administration protocol, the workstation service remote protocol, server service remote protocol, the DFS namespace protocol, and the file server resource manager remote protocol. So those are the protocols that comprise the file services system. And this document treats all of them. So how do we do this? Well, we progress through a whole series of more and more detail of description, starting after an overview, starting with some use cases which discuss typical user system interaction. In this case, a user is not really a person, it's an application that's speaking file access, right? Then we present some block diagrams which make it easier to see which components talk to which other components using what protocols and what they're talking about. There's a fairly extensive section on the data model, which is detailing state elements that are maintained by protocols. And one of the complications in this system is that some of the protocols affect state elements that determine the behavior of other protocols or can sense the state of other protocols. So there's a sort of an interplay between multiple protocols that is not very evident from the individual system documents. So we tried to make that, that's a big part of the presentation here. We have some layering diagrams that show the transport relationships and an extensive amount of number of sequence diagrams which were done. This was an amazing process that we followed of using NetMon to capture protocol sequences, as you guys do, talking to the programmers and to find out what they think really should be going on, and basically working the two ends towards the middle to really get an understanding of what actually is going on and what we're seeing on the what of what we're seeing on the wire is actually real and what is just, you know, environmental noise from, you know, other Windows behavior that is necessary but not directly related to the file services.
So what you're saying is you feel our pain?
Yes. Yeah. I have had a direct experience of that, actually. Actually, I think it has proven, this is sort of an aside, but I think it's proven to us the value of doing a lot of protocol analysis in addition to just writing code. We found several opportunities to make our code better through the protocol analysis that we did. I had a question over here.
So these sequence diagrams and the network tracing, are they just dumped in there into the docs without explanation, or are they actually summarized down to sort of something that's a bit more followable? Because, I mean, I've seen docs with just lumps of NetMon dump, and that's not documentation. That's a NetMon dump in a PDF.
Right. I hope you'll agree that they're pretty well documented and actually somewhat abstracted from NetMon. But they are well-rooted in NetMon traces, so we actually have the NetMon traces to back up the sequence diagrams.
Okay, so I can download the doc and the NetMon trace that it's talking about and see.
You will be able to, yeah.
Reference.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, and but the sequence diagrams were drawn by hand, independently of NetMon. Okay. And of course, this document is intended to complement and not to duplicate the technical documents. And this was one of the biggest challenges in writing the document. Since we're describing the system as a whole, it's tempting to go into great depth in every place that you're in the system. And yet, if you go beyond a certain point, you're getting into the detail that's described in the technical documents. So as you read the document, you'll find yourself, you'll see where we had to restrain ourselves because almost every section there's like, okay, and now for more detail, refer to this document, this section. It's still 150 pages long, despite that. Okay. So here's a standard table of contents for all of the system overview documents that are being developed. And there's quite a number of them. I couldn't tell you the exact number, actually, but it's
19.
Thank you, Neil. Neil Martin. Neil's helping keep track of the whole process of doing the system overview docs. So here's the outline. The outline very laboriously peels the onion layer by layer, getting more and more detail as we go down through the document. And one of the consequences of that, for any of you who've tried to write something that top down, you probably know that it winds up being rather repetitive. And so let's tell the story again, but with just a little more detail, or tell the story again with a sort of a shift right on the detail axis. You know, leave off a little bit of the abstraction and add a little more detail and repeat everything in the middle, right? So that's we really struggled with that as we went through this document, trying to add interesting new detail at every layer of description. And I hope you'll agree that we largely succeeded in that. What I'm going to talk about today in this talk are some of what I think are the key sections of the document, which are underlined here in this outline. That's where I think we have actually added a lot of useful information in this document. So. And we've already spoken about the list of member protocols. And so the real technical content of the document really begins here with this discussion of use cases. So how many people are familiar with UML use cases in this room? How many have used them extensively in your work? Right, okay. That was pretty much the picture at Microsoft too. So we... when we were told to follow this template, we go, oh, use cases, oh yeah, okay, yeah, sure. You know, we've all seen that. We thought that's going to be easy. This actually turned out to be quite a bit of work for us because It turned out it's a lot easier to read a use case than it is to write one. And most of us had been readers of, but not writers of use cases. So the use cases are all introduced with a high-level diagram like this. And here what we've done is we've actually applied a little slightly non-standard UML here by grouping together a bunch of use cases into a description of a higher level use case. The use cases in the document are described at two levels. One is called summary use cases, and the other one is called detail use cases. And one of the summary use cases is this one called find file in work group. It's like somewhat of an artificial scenario, but it's set up to walk the system through a whole sequence of operations that's somewhat representative of real life. So in this case, the application, this is the thing called the direct actor here, the application is asking the system to first give him a list of computers that are in the work group, and then to explore the shares that are offered by a certain computer that the user selects, and then to do a directory listing, basically list the files that are on that directory. And then finally, the user selects a file and opens it. And we use this open file DFS use case, which shows how DFS plays into the open process. And then the perform file operation is a sort of an aggregate use case that reflects all the handle-based operations that you can do in the system. So this big box here represents the system. This represents the use cases that it implements for this overall summary use case. And then one thing that's probably the most important aspect of these diagrams is the actors on the right-hand side. Those are the things that are known as supporting actors. Those are systems or things that are outside of the system under discussion, but which come into play in fulfilling the use case. So for example, in listing computers, a reference is made to the browser service to accomplish that task. So there are four summary use cases in the document. And then they call into a total of, I think it's 15 detail use cases. Well, I'll check that later. You can count them. The four summary use cases, again, are representative of typical operations. There's a configure use case, which takes us through many administrative steps of setting up a file environment. There's this find file in work group, which I just described. There's an analogous one called find file in domain, which is essentially the same task, but in an environment that has a domain controller and is domain-centric. And then there's this one called communicate through shared file, which we constructed to show how SMB and NFS can collaborate to share files in a system. And the detail use cases fall into two categories. One where the admin tool is the primary actor, the direct actor. These are the administrative use cases. The other where the application is the direct actor. So those are the ones that are more related to opening files and doing data access. So I've just listed the names of the use cases here. Now these use cases are important because they're later developed into the protocol sequence diagrams. So the use case description is kind of a high level and kind of an introduction to what you're going to see in the protocol sequence diagram. So here's an example of one of the detail use cases. This one's called Open File DFS. It's something that's done by the application. Now the use case includes a whole bunch of stuff which I haven't detailed here, but I've just got the section heading. So there's a diagram, there's a goal statement, there's a context of use, there's an identification of the actors. A minimal guarantee, a success guarantee, standard use case stuff. And then the real core of the use case here is this thing called the main success scenario, which is a fairly high-level description of the interactions that take place in the successful case of opening a file using DFS. And you can see here, this is probably pretty elementary for most of you who've worked on SMB protocol here. In step three, we're showing three alternate cases, depending on which protocol is being used. And this is the whole scenario, which is later elaborated into a sequence diagram. The other main part of the use cases are the extensions, and the extensions are alternative scenarios. So the main success scenario describes the usual case when everything goes right, and the extensions describe a few things that might happen when things go wrong or when something slightly unexpected can happen. Now, another key part, this is in chapter 4 now, of the decomposition, we finally get into what's a system black box. So this is the file services black box. It's not actually black, it's actually a gray box. But this rectangle here in the middle that's gray represents the system itself and establishes the scope of what's inside the system and what's outside the system. And this is somewhat arbitrary, and believe me, probably the biggest problem we had in doing this work over the last 6 months was actually getting crisp on just defining what is this system that we're talking about, since there is, you know, historically there was no such thing as a file services system in the Windows architecture, nor for that matter were any of these other systems defined as, you know, cleanly, you know, black boxes like this. Windows is a lot of services and a lot of code and a lot of protocols, but it's not so much clearly defined subsystems, or wasn't, and perhaps it's getting more clearly defined now. So this is the file services system, and I think what's interesting about this is there's this thing called the object store, which is outside of the system. The object store is loosely synonymous, I mean, it's an abstraction for the local file system that's being used and presented by the file services system. The reason why we put the object store outside of the system is because in Windows there's a number of different local file systems that you can use to present file services. And the semantics that you get change a little bit depending on what file system you're using. Most commonly you're using NTFS, and so it's driven by NTFS semantics. But SMB protocols are a little bit different from NFS. NFS actually defines what it's like to interact with a network file system. The network file system has a semantic that's defined by NFS. SMB protocols are more like an extension cord that says, you know, you can interoperate, you know, over the wire with that thing that's out there. And, you know, some of the interaction, I can see you're agreeing with my statement here. Some of the interaction is defined by SMB and some of it's left up to the underlying file system. And so that's a key thing to be aware of. And there is a document under preparation that's called MSDN FSBO that actually describes how the object store behaves in the overall picture. So the file service is the thing that sits on top of the object store and actually makes it remotely accessible. And also all the protocols operate in here. And then this file client is an abstraction of the piece of the application that's inside of the black box and is at the terminus of the protocols and talking to the file service. Likewise, we have an admin client, which is the similar component for the admin tool. This separation is somewhat arbitrary. Most of you who've worked in the field know that it's very difficult in practice to differentiate management stuff from, you know, data access stuff. They're somewhat interleaved with each other. But we made this differentiation to try to maintain the separation between administrative tasks and data tasks. Now, the other things around the outside are all the supporting services that the file services system sometimes interacts with. And one of the interesting things about the file services system is that these dependencies that are depicted here are not true dependencies. The system will work, actually, in every case. I'm just checking myself. Yeah, it'll work in every case if one of these external components is absent. It just works differently if the components are present. So for example, the system will work without access to Active Directory, but it has restricted functionality in that case. Then also, for example, it shows print services over there, which actually uses file services to do some of its operation. One thing that's important as you read these documents is to recognize that we're discussing the SMB protocols here as used to implement file services, so we don't actually discuss how they're used to implement print services in this document. But there's another document called Print Services Overview that discusses that. So the next big section is the abstract data model. And this is many, many, many pages of a fairly detailed description of state elements. You can find these state elements in each of the technical documents. Each of the technical documents has an abstract data model and talks about how the protocol's state changes as the protocol is operating. But it doesn't actually tell you what could be very interesting, which is that other protocols can look into those state elements and possibly even change those state elements. And so there are interactions between the protocols. And that's what's depicted here in this diagram. So for example, if you look at this shared state here, connection list, session list, transport list, and so on, the server service can retrieve these. In some cases, it can set some of these components, some of these variables. And then they affect how the SMB protocols work. So those types of interactions are detailed in this section of the document. Yeah, Chris?
So the server service you're talking about is not what most SMB developers, I'll do this again,
right? I just want to make the fine point that the server service you're talking about is not the one that most SMB developers know. In mm-hmm. our terminology, the server service is the SMB server. So that term is used in the SMB SIFS world to mean the SMB SIFS server.
Okay, so let me take that opportunity to make a fine point here about this nomenclature. See this in brackets here, MS, SRBS? That's actually a reference to this protocol that's known as the Microsoft Server Service Remote Management Protocol, right? So maybe instead of saying server service, I should say SRBS to make that less confusing. So there, in this section of the document, there are many of these diagrams, and then there's a whole lot of text that talks about the state elements and how they're shared between the protocols. So now the next thing is protocol layering. This is discussed also in Chapter 5. And so we've produced one of them. These should be familiar charts for any of you who've seen these, like the big network poster that shows all protocol layering. This default relationship that's depicted here is really a transported by relationship. So SIFS is transported by, among other things, NetBUI. It's transported by NetBIOS over IPX and by NetBIOS over TCP. SMB2. Now has a mode where it can be directly transported over TCP, which is actually its preferred mode of operation, which is something completely new. And I think the other thing that's interesting to observe from this chart is sort of there's a sort of a tendency here to move through to the right over time. So these transport mappings are less used now. Certainly the NetBIOS over TCP is still very prevalently used in Windows. But what's emerging is this direct transport over TCP. Another thing to point out here is we have this relationship called includes. FSCC is not really a protocol in the sense of something that has an addressed protocol data unit that could be transported by something else. Instead, what FSCC is a kind of a big data dictionary that describes how certain fields of the SMB protocol are programmed. Are set. It's actually just common information that's factored out of the SMB and the SMB2 documents. And so it's sort of like it's a transport relationship because the bits that are defined by FSCC wind up inside of SMB frames. But the correct relationship really is includes, really included by reference in those specifications. Sir?
So the content that is in...
Oh, microphone, hold.
So the content that is in MSFSCC does not appear,
does not physically appear in the MSSMB document.
That's right.
But is understood to be part of it.
Yes, okay. Yeah. It's essentially incorporated by reference. Right. Yeah, it's important to read FSAC to get the full understanding of SMB or of SMB2.
Right.
But incidentally, not of SIFS. The original SIFS protocol, is such as it is, you know, it's complete unto itself, and it's being made more complete by through Chris's efforts. Okay. The other thing that's thematically interesting about this picture is that these are all the data transport protocols, and interestingly, they more or less run either on NetBIOS or directly on TCP, as you might expect a data transport protocol to do. The one anomaly from that picture is the remote administration protocol, MSRAP. MSRAP actually is transported by SMB in the same way that a data protocol would be. However, it is not transported by SMB2, and this was something that was a new idea for me. And
MSRPC should be on that list too?
It's not on the next page.
It's on the next page, very
okay.
Good. And on the transports for SIFS, there is also direct hosting IPX, which isn't dead almost, but it's there.
Uh-huh.
Transport.
Direct on IPX.
Direct on IPX.
Oh, yes.
Direct on connectionless IPX, okay.
Yes. Okay, we'll be back to you on that.
Yeah.
Jim, can you take a note of that?
Well,
Chris noticed something.
Part of the weird game,
part of the weird game that you end up playing, SMB is actually a very, very, very old protocol. And so at what point does it become kind of an interesting discussion of history versus a discussion of how to interoperate? The history discussion is a great thing to do over beers. To me, it's a distraction to put into a document to talk about things that happened in 1980, because it's not relevant if you're going to try to read the doc to be able to figure out how the heck do you interoperate. It bulks the document up. And so there's, for this document specifically, we're scoped, I'm sorry, Randy, what's the oldest OS that we're supposed to scope to?
Windows 2000.
Yeah. And so the scoping is, we only go back to certain transports supported at that time frame.
You're going to need some exercise. That's a little bit like
a lock vector, right?
I want to say I absolutely agree. On the other hand, you do have direct hosting IPX in MSSMB right now. It's there. And the only reason I bring it up is that if it's still listed, I don't know where to make that, draw that line.
Yeah, this is a minutia, but the scoping of the system documents is from 2000 onward. The scoping of the TDs goes back further in time. So that's somewhat of an arbitrary distinction. But
right, and I guess my only point there is I don't always know where, and I'm looking for that guidance, but I don't always know where those lines are myself, so.
Yeah.
So do we.
We spent an inordinate amount of time just trying to figure out how to draw these two boxes right here. I hope you appreciate how they're drawn. Because that represents about 2 man-months worth of work that went into that. So, but what's relevant today is mostly still NetBIOS over TCP and then the TCP Direct. The other thing to say about MSRAP is that, you know, the current generation machines use MSRAP only for two APIs, the NetServer Enum2 and NetServer Enum3. And that's the only current use of RAP in the SR.
There's also, we're also finding in writing our document, we're also finding it very hard to make a distinction between, you know, interesting beer talk and something that needs to be documented by the simple fact that, you know, this is something, it may be something that's so old that nobody actually uses it, but there might be archaic subsystems that in the operating system that when the operating system interacts with our protocol, it uses these old things that nobody's supposed to be using.
That's what you need NetMon for.
Yeah.
Let's find those things out. Yeah, so let me go on here in the interest of time. There's another protocol layering diagram. This one is mostly about the administrative protocols. As I said a moment ago, RAP is an exception because RAP is an administrative protocol that's transported by SMB and TCP directly. The more modern communication administration protocols are transported by MSRPC, which then is carried by SMB, right? Which you can read in RPCE about all that, and that's why that's not in this diagram, right? But what is in this diagram is the particular transport paths that are followed below RPC. That's what these indicate is the transport bindings that follow below. So these three guys are transported by RPC over SMB. And the anomaly on this chart is with FSRM, because FSRM is a decom protocol, which is then not transported over SMB. It's transported by directly by TCP. So it uses a different protocol mapping. So, okay, here's one of the most exciting diagrams in the whole document. I hope you guys are like this one. Yes, drawn in Visio. So that's a lot of what this one does. This is actually one of the first diagrams we drew, interestingly enough, when we were trying to figure out how we were going to describe the file services system. We said, okay, well, it must have some components. Let's start drawing some boxes and see. So this is you know, a box and knob type diagram. So here's the file client and the admin client. And then over here, we've taken the the file service and expanded it slightly to these sub-blocks, a DFS service, SMB service, FSRM, and NFS. And we've also got the DFS service on the domain controller as part of the file services system. So this box here represents the external domain controller, the dotted line box. And then all these connections, these things that we called arcs when we were drawing them originally, we just labeled with, okay, what protocols are used between these two components? And we kept working this diagram until we got enough components that we could actually separate the protocols to where you could read them, you know, as well as you can do here. And we thought, well, that's perhaps an interesting detail. So, for example, this also led us to the conclusion that the browser service is external to the file system services, because it's used not only by file services but by other services and in locating computers. And so we have the browser, the BRWS protocol follows this arc to locate backup browsers, and then it uses MSWrap, interestingly, to get the list of servers. So that's how you read this diagram, and I hope you'll find that one useful. It also shows the interactions with the external components. And then we have a corresponding table that's quite long. This is just the first few rows. From the table. What this is doing is detailing the information that's on the arcs in the prior diagram. So the way you read this is it says component one uses protocol to talk to component two for what purpose? And there's many, many rows in this chart trying to explain, you know, why is this communication happening at a fairly high level. Okay, so now we get into the fun part, the sequence diagrams. Okay. My opinion of all of UML sequence diagrams are the best and most useful part. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but no, different opinion over there. Okay. That's good beer talk. Something we've done with these sequence diagrams, which you may not be familiar with, is because there's quite a bunch of content in one of these overall interactions, we have had to abstract the sequence diagrams into sub-diagrams. right. This is legal UML syntax, we're pretty sure. we followed, there's a book called Writing Effective Use Cases from Cockburn that we followed in writing the use cases. And then in doing the sequence diagrams, we mostly referred to the actual UML spec, but also to a book called the UML Reference that describes how to do the sequence diagrams. So What this indicates here is an alternative. You know, either this happens or this happens, and there are these gating functions here. So that's something that's kind of interesting. And then this ref is essentially a call to another sequence diagram, which is the one on the next page. So this is one of the more complex sequence diagrams that's in the document, and it deals with, you know, how do you open a file given a UNC path name. So that's the input parameters there. And it starts here with the application, you know, talking to the file client and saying, which is really the kernel part of the application, saying, you know, please open that file. The first thing that has to happen is to determine if the UNC path is a DFS path. And here we were really challenged, because how many of you have read the DFSC document that describes how this determination is done? A show of hands. Thomas has read it. You probably proofread it. Yeah. Well, it's about a 5 or 6 page flow chart in that document that describes in detail the algorithm for dereferencing a UNC path name and determining whether the thing is really a DFS path or not. So that note is really a reference to that flow chart in the DFSC specification. Okay, so you can see the reference there in DFSC and the section number. So there's quite a lot of hierarchy in this stuff, but we hope that this still says, okay, at least we've oriented you, go look there, and that's where that detail is. So that comes back here, and then if it is a DFS path, again, we're making a reference here, we're performing the open using the methods that are described in that DFSC. And if not, then we're dropping into the normal SMB open path, which is described actually on the next chart. So this is a reference to another sequence diagram here, and after doing that, well, then we're done. We've got our file handle. Okay, and it's returned that way. So, okay, on the next page, then, I have got the example of a referenced sequence diagram, which is the open file SMB, which itself has a further reference. Okay. So this one comes in here, and it checks to see, first of all, I want to open this file. Do I have a, can I go on for just a second? Okay, so it checks to see, well, do I have a session set up? Well, if not, then we reference this other sequence diagram for how do you set up a session. Okay, then we go on to say, well, has the tree connect been done? And again, if not, we will go and do the tree connect. And then finally, we can do the SMB2 create operation, which sets up the session. Sir.
Yes. Question about how you have these things now. Up there it says SMB application.
Right. Yeah, I don't think you're
on
the air.
Yeah. Okay. Up there it says SMB application. Is that the application that is calling
the
client?
That's the client app. It's the SMB client application, right? The one that's calling out to do the reference.
All right. What's the difference then between the SMB application and the SMB file client?
Okay. For that, you have to go to the black box. So this is the SMB application here. It's something outside of the system.
Okay.
And the file client is just a piece of application code that's inside of the system. If you want to think about it concretely, which is sometimes a mistake here, but if you want to think about it concretely, it would be, you know, the kernel components that are at the near side of the at the connections for the SMB session.
I'm more trying to think about it in the sense of how we use this to read the MSSMB document. Since the MSSMB document has sections labeled application request reading a file.
Right, right. I think it's roughly comparable.
Well, when you read the SMB doc, think of it as that box is one box, even though it's subdivided into two. It's very artificial.
There's a template issue where, you know, there's a template that we must adhere to, uppercase must. And so we had to create, honestly, some artificial mechanisms to make it so that things fit in terms of a black box, white box relationship. So this box, to me, is the application that's calling down to the NT APIs to be able to cause file traffic going across the network.
Well, One way to think about it is that this is the user mode application, and this is the kernel-based, you know, NT API thing. But that's only one way to think about it, and you know, it wouldn't apply to your way of a Unix-based implementation.
Right. I mean, yeah. To me, it is very artificial, and from a wire perspective, who gives a crap?
Yeah.
So more.
Mostly I'm just trying to make sure that the document we're writing is approaching this from the same angle that you guys are, so
yeah.
We should get together after this, I'm thinking.
Yes, I think that's probably a good idea, yeah. Okay, so somewhere earlier we had a question of, do you guys really explain what's happening in those arcs? And so with every one of these sequence diagrams, there's a step-by-step explanation of, you know, what's going on. Here's just an example. I think actually this is the complete example of the SMB sequence diagram for the open. And you can see it's talking about, you know, which operations are used and making references to the specs and to the section numbers. All of this will be carefully converted to XML so that when we do the daily builds of all the documents, all of these section numbers will be adjusted daily. But all the cross references will remain valid, he says with more confidence than maybe is warranted. But that's the intention. Okay, so there's a lot of text describing the sequence diagrams. So much of this was brought to you by Netmon version 3.3, and. I just wanted to put a little plug in for Netmon. If you haven't tried using it, it's getting a lot better with 3.3 just finished beta. I think it's actually been released, and you can download it. It has a lot of improvements in it, and I don't do it justice by listing only really two or one. But the most important one is that it, due to our efforts, and particularly not mine, but somebody else on our team, it now correctly decodes compound SMB2 operations. And this is, I was the one who found this bug because I was struggling to understand what the heck's going on here. Why can't I see this compound operation? It's because the parser wasn't parsing it properly. So now it does. And we fixed several other minor bugs along the way, and there's a whole bunch of new features that have been added, including the ability to write comments on protocol arcs and so on. So. It's been a great tool for all of us who are involved in this effort, some of us were approaching it from the tracing side, trying to figure out what the system actually does, somewhat naively because we were less familiar with the code. And then we had people on the other side who were telling us, coming from the other side, saying, you know, they were familiar with the code and saying it works like this. We had to put those two points of view together. And like I said earlier in the talk, that was a very exciting process. And actually was helpful for us. We found a few opportunities to improve the implementation of the code through that process. So I'm a big fan of looking at what actually happens on in the wire. And I hope you guys will have a chance. I hope you will. You certainly will have the chance. We're going to, when this document is finished, it'll be posted. And the traces that were taken with Netmon that drove the development of the sequence diagrams, they'll be posted also, so you'll be able to correlate the two of them together. And last, but I think this is last and not least, there's an important appendix in this document that deals with how NFS runs on Windows servers and how the NFS semantics are mapped to SMB and to the underlying file system. So a lot of this stuff that's discussed in this section is kind of like the mirror image of some of the discussions that I've been hearing earlier in the week here about supporting SMB over POSIX compliant file systems. This is the inverse. It's supporting NFS over Windows compliant NTFS. So this may not be directly useful, but it may be still helpful to you in looking at the inverse mappings. So that's the first time that this information, by the way, will have been published by Microsoft. Okay, so schedule. We had a very important milestone just before we came to the conference. The conference was well-timed. So we actually have completed the first draft of the document. It's complete, though not finished yet. There's going to be a number of interim review milestones before it becomes published, and we're looking for a target release in the early summer timeframe. And with that, I'll open it up for any other questions. Any other comments? So somebody ask by a show of hands, how many of you will eagerly consume this document? Well, I know. Yeah, I know you have an artificial reason to do so, but still a good one. Yeah, but I think I saw about four or five hands. Can I ask, what's your motivation? What's your interest in consuming it? Maybe we'll start with you.
Maybe not specifically this one, but some of the other overview documents, particularly for Active Directory, where it's not specified so well, that the stuff that's not in MS-ATDS and sort of splits off but into a dozen different docs. Some of the overview there, I'm really looking forward to seeing. And I appreciate seeing the things tied together nicely. It's nice just to see the relationships.
That reminds me to mention, we, of course, made reference to ADSO. One of the things that was fun about doing this was that all these other system documents are in the same, largely the same state of preparation as ours is. So we're negotiating these boundaries with them, as we were developing this. And we found that the ADSO document, which deals with Active Directory, it was actually a very good resource for us. And also the OFSO document that deals with how authentication is done and treats NTLM and Kerberos and all that. Was a very great resource for us in writing our document. And there's actually an entire section of OFSO that's actually devoted to file services, to how authorization, authentication happens in the file services application. So that's necessary reading for implementing a file server. Yeah, anybody else?
I think developers who are new to SMB, but are put on it, as a new project, this will help really get them up to speed quicker with what is the initial packet flow of SMB communication.
So good.
I'm happy about that.
Good. Yeah, I'm hopeful. That's certainly. I think my feeling is it probably will be more helpful to people coming newly into the game than to people who have been there for a long time. For that, the people who have the big picture already. Are probably profiting more from the detailed protocol docs themselves. Okay, anybody else? All right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.